up on the Internet. These observations will be critical later on when I consider dark matter's role in triggering meteoroid impacts. The meteor crater. Before diving into impact crater formation and the full list of those here on Earth, let's take a moment to reflect on the first one found, one of the earliest discoveries to tie together objects from the sky with the surface of the Earth. See the photo in Figure 22 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook. Although the name is a little off, remember, meteor is the streak in the air, the meteor crater was at least formed by a meteoroid, as by definition are all impact craters. This particular crater is located near Flagstaff, Arizona. Its name correlates with a nearby post office in accordance with a meteoroid naming convention. Theodore Roosevelt established the post office in 1906 when his friend Daniel Barringer, a mining engineer and businessman, started investigating the mysterious crater's contents and origin. Geologists were initially skeptical of his proposal, but Barringer ultimately showed that the crater originated in a meteoroid. The depression is also known as the Barringer Crater, in recognition of his contribution. Though bigger impact structures exist, the crater is among the largest in the United States, measuring some 1,200 meters across and 170 meters deep, with a rim that rises about 45 meters. It is about 50,000 years old, and you can see it right on the surface of the Earth. If it wasn't obvious from a map, you can tell the crater is in America, since, like many things American, it is privately owned. The Barringer family holds the title through the Barringer Crater Company and currently charge $16 to see it. The ownership was secured in 1903 when Daniel Barringer staked a claim along with the mathematician and physicist Benjamin Chu Tillman, which was soon afterwards signed by the president. The company staking the claim, the Standard Iron Company, was given permission to mine with a 640-acre land patent. Because it is private property, the crater cannot be part of the national park system. Only federally owned land can house a national monument, so it is merely a national natural landmark. The good part of that is that it doesn't get closed when the government shuts down, as occurred in 2013 when I started writing this chapter. The other good thing about private ownership is that the Barringers have a vested interest in preserving the crater, and it is indeed considered the world's best preserved meteor impact site, though its relatively recent origin helps a lot, too. The meteorite associated with the crater is called the Diablo meteorite, named after the ghost town of Canyon Diablo, located along the canyon sporting the same name. The associated 50-meter-wide meteoroid, composed of almost pure iron and nickel, probably hit the ground at about 13 kilometers per second, generating at least 2 megatons of TNT worth of energy, a few times as much as Chelyabinsk, or roughly the energy of a hydrogen bomb. Most of the initial object was vaporized, making fragments difficult to find. Pieces that have been located are on display in the museum there, and some are even for sale. The paucity of fragments made it difficult at first to ascertain that the crater was in fact formed by an extraterrestrial object, rather than by a volcano, as the European settlers who first ran across it in the 19th century had assumed. This wasn't an unreasonable hypothesis at the time, given how exotic an extraterrestrial explanation must have seemed, and how misleading the proximity of the San Francisco volcano field, only 40 miles west, must have been. In an illuminating story of science gone wrong, and only later put right, the U.S. Geological Survey's chief geologist, Grove Carl Gilbert, made his official determination that it was a volcano in 1891. Gilbert had heard about the crater from the Philadelphia mineral dealer Arthur Foote, who was interested in the iron that shepherds in 1887 had found nearby. Foote had recognized the extraterrestrial origin of the metal and visited the site to see what else he could dig up. In addition to iron, he found microscopic diamonds. These had been formed on impact, but Foote, not knowing this, had incorrectly thought the object that had hit had been as large as the moon. Foote made a further mistake in that he didn't associate the crater with the meteorite material he was investigating. Despite his acceptance of the extraterrestrial origin of the material on the ground, in his mind, the nearby crater was a separate phenomenon that had been created by volcanic activity. On the other hand, Gilbert, who had learned about the crater from Foote, was one of the first to propose that it had originated from a meteoroid. But in his attempt to scientifically verify his claim, Gilbert too came to the wrong conclusion. Since no one yet understood the morphology of impact craters, he incorrectly ruled out his impact hypothesis because the mass in the rim did not agree with the missing mass from the crater, and also because the shape was circular and not elliptical, as he would have predicted for an impact arriving from a particular direction. Furthermore, no one found any magnetic evidence for a difference in iron content that would have indicated something extraterrestrial. Given the lack of evidence of a meteoroid, Gilbert was compelled by his own methodology, which neglected the more subtle elements of impact crater formation that I will soon describe, to mistakenly conclude that volcanic activity, and not an impact, had been responsible for the crater. The crater's origin was correctly pinned down at last when Barringer and Tillman published a couple of extraordinary papers in the 1905 Proceedings of the Academy of the Natural Sciences of Philadelphia, in which they demonstrated that the meteor crater did indeed result from an extraterrestrial impact. Their evidence included the overturned rim strata, which I'm told is truly spectacular to see, and nickel oxide in the sediment. However, the 30 tons of oxidized iron meteorite fragments around the crater led Barringer to make a different and costly mistake. Barringer thought most of the rest of the iron would be buried underground, and spent 27 years drilling to find it. Its discovery would have been another bonanza for the man who in 1894 had made $15 million, more than a billion in today's dollars, from the Commonwealth Silver Mine, which was also in Arizona. But the meteorite was smaller than Barringer had thought, and anyway, most of a meteorite vaporizes on impact, so he didn't make any money or successfully convince many people of the crater's origin, even after his excavation was complete. Barringer died of a heart attack a few months after the president of the Meteor Crater Exploration and Mining Company, a venture Barringer had helped create, closed down operations. Barringer and his company lost $600,000 on prospecting the crater, but at least Barringer did live long enough to vindicate his hypothesis. As planetary science advanced and people finally began to more fully understand crater formation, more scientists were won over to Barringer's deduction. The final confirmation came in 1960 when Eugene Merle Shoemaker, a key player in scientific understanding of impacts, found rare forms of silica at the crater that could only have arisen from rocks containing quartz that were severely shocked by impact pressure. Aside from a nuclear explosion, unlikely 50,000 years in the past, a meteoroid impact is the only possible known cause. Indeed, Shoemaker carefully mapped the crater and showed the similarity between its geology and that produced around nuclear explosion craters in Nevada. His analysis legitimized the concept of an extraterrestrial impact on Earth and marked a milestone in Earth science's absorbing the significance of the Earth's interaction with its cosmic environment. Impact crater formation. My joy in rock climbing comes in no small part from my pleasure in examining the material, texture, and density of rocks, closely inspecting the surfaces to identify the safest and most efficient route up. But the real treasure buried in rocks is their long history. Along with the evidence of tectonic plate movement that they display, rocks' morphology and composition provide a trove of information for geologists to evaluate. Paleontologists, too, learn a great deal from the Earth's embedded fossils and its terrain. Rock formations always tell a story, and some locations are particularly spectacular in this respect. On a recent university visit to the Basque Country in Bilbao, Spain, I was very lucky to have a physics colleague tell me about the Flix Geopark in the nearby town of Zumaya. The geopark is an active ecotourism site that features an incredible limestone outcrop representing millions of years of geological history. Fascinating both for its use of the geological treasures there to provide sustainable economic development and for its diverse scientific activity and discoveries. When I visited the geopark, the scientific director there pointed out to me the 60 million year span of rock layers readily visible across the vertical cliff, which was wonderfully situated along a stunning beach. There's a photo in figure 23 on the enhancement. He described the cliff as an open book, with every page visible at the same time. The KT boundary, now officially known as the KPG boundary, which I'll return to later, separates the layer of white rock with fossils from the grayer layer above without them. This line that marks the last major extinction is well preserved in this quiet site in the Basque Country. But such magnificent layers of rocks aren't the only way to learn about the past. Impact craters, which are some of the most remarkable formations on the Earth's surface, constitute a very different wellspring of information. Despite our limited knowledge of how and when meteoroids will strike, scientists understand quite a lot about impact craters' geology. A crater's shape, rock morphology, and composition provide clues that help to distinguish impact craters from calderas or other round depressions. And since impact craters' distinctive appearance and composition can be understood in large part from their origin, the depressions and special rock types where meteoroids made groundfall tell us a lot about the events that created the craters in the first place. If the words hadn't already been corrupted by a spectacularly unsuccessful military policy, the words shock and awe would probably be the most cogent description of impact craters' formation. Impact craters are the result of extraterrestrial objects hitting the Earth with sufficient energy to create a shockwave that excavates a circular crater, which is awesome indeed. The shockwave, not the direct impact, is responsible for the circular shape of impact craters. A more direct excavation would instead produce a depression with a preferred orientation that would reflect the impactor's initial direction, not something that looks the same all around. This was the red herring that misdirected Gilbert's Barringer crater analysis. But the crater can't simply be understood as an impactor pushing down on rock. The crater is created when the impactor pushes down so much on the Earth that the compressed region acts like a piston, which rapidly decompresses to release stress, rebounding from the initial impact and ejecting material. The release of the pressure through the hemispheric pattern of the shock wave is the actual explosion that creates the crater. This subsurface explosion gives rise to the impact crater's distinctive circular form. Objects that form impact craters usually hit the ground at speeds up to 8 times the Earth's escape velocity, which is 11 kilometers per second, with roughly 20 to 25 kilometers per second most typical. For larger objects, this speed, many times the speed of sound, guarantees that an enormous amount of kinetic energy gets released, since kinetic energy grows not only with the mass, but with the square of the speed. An impact on solid rock, which can be comparable to a nuclear blast, produces shock waves that compress both the object from space and the surface on Earth. The shock released on impact heats up the material it encounters, and almost always melts and vaporizes the entering meteoroid, and, with sufficiently big meteoroids, regions of the target, too. The expanding supersonic wave creates stress levels far in excess of the local material's strength. This creates rare crystalline structures, such as shocked quartz, that are found only in impact craters and in the blast region of nuclear explosions. An example is given in Figure 24, on the enhanced portion of this audiobook. Other distinctive features include shatter cones in rock, which are conically shaped structures whose apexes point to the collision point, as illustrated in Figure 25. Take a look at it on the enhancement. Shatter cones are also clear evidence of a high-pressure event that again can be accounted for only by impacts or nuclear events. Shatter cones are interesting in that they range from millimeters to meters in length, thereby providing a macroscopic scale effect in the material. Along with crystal deformations and evidence of melted rock, shatter cones help distinguish craters that truly represent impact events. Other rock forms that are characteristic of impacts are those formed at high temperatures. Known as tektites and impact melt spherules, these are glassy materials that have their origin in molten rock. As these are generated by high temperature and not necessarily high pressure, they can conceivably also originate in volcanoes, generally the chief contenders to impacts for crater formation. But impact craters generally have a different chemical composition, including metals and other materials, such as nickel, platinum, iridium, and cobalt, that are rare on the Earth's surface. These additional clues help corroborate an impact origin. The chemical composition of the impactor can have other distinctive features as well. For example, particular isotopes, atoms with the same charge but different numbers of neutrons, might be more typical of extraterrestrial formations, though this will be useful only for a small percentage of the remaining material, since most of the original matter is vaporized. Also useful in distinguishing craters are impact breccias, which consist of fragments of rock held together by a fine-grained matrix of material, again indicating an impact that shattered what was initially there. Shocked fused glasses are also interesting, in that their formation requires both high pressure and temperature. Their unusually high density helps identify them. Another notable feature can be dikes within the crater floor or central sheets that line the floor of complex structures formed from glass particles. These distinctive shock and melt features are critical to confirming impact events, since there is no other way for them to form. However, they aren't always easy to find, as they can be deeply buried under rock fragments and melt. Nonetheless, meteorites abound, and many natural history museums display examples. I like the 7-foot-high, 34-ton Aniguito meteorite at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, which is the largest on display. This enormous rock was a later acquisition, added to the meteorite collection that the museum has housed since its creation in 1869. Materials help identify impact craters, but so do their distinctive shapes. Whereas impact craters are depressions below the surrounding regions, most volcanic craters arise from eruptions and are found above the level of the surrounding terrain. Impact craters also have raised rims, again not typical for volcanic craters. Another identifying feature is the inverted stratigraphy in the ejecta blanket, a consequence of material being excavated and then flipping over outside the crater, resembling the edge of a stack of large pancakes. The deep, roughly circular depression in the surface of the Earth, or on any planet or moon, with a raised rim and inverted stratigraphy, is also clear evidence that a massive body hit the surface at enormous speed. Though the materials distinguishing impact craters are mostly shaped during the sudden shock release, the crater's shape relies on the subsequent formation history, too. Initially, when hitting the target, the impactor decelerates while the target material accelerates. The hit, compression, decompression, and the outflow of the shock wave all happen within a few tenths of a second. Once the shock wave has passed, changes occur more slowly. The accelerated material that got hit, having been accelerated by the initial wave, keeps moving even after the shock wave has decayed away, but at this stage, the motion is subsonic. Even so, the crater continues to form, with the crater rim rising and more material ejected. The crater isn't yet stable, however, and gravity will make it collapse. For small craters, the rim falls down a bit, and debris heads down the walls of the crater, with melted material flowing into the deeper portion of the crater. The end result is still bowl-shaped and looks a lot like the crater that initially formed, but it might be considerably smaller. The meteor crater, for example, is half its original size. Afterward, breccias and melted and ejected rock fill in the cavity. The shape of a simple crater is illustrated in Figure 26, which you can see on the enhancement. Larger impacts not only displace and eject material, but also vaporize part of the original ground that got hit. This melted material can coat the inside of the cavity, while the vaporized material typically expands away, creating, in effect, a mushroom cloud. Most of the coarser material will drop down within a few crater radii, but some of the more finely grained matter can be dispersed around the globe. When the impactor is bigger than a kilometer across, the craters formed will be 20 kilometers or larger. The impactor in this case essentially creates a hole in the atmosphere and ejecta fill this vacuum, going upward before descending over a wide area. The hottest material can rise above the stratosphere, and the fireball of vaporized material can then be widely dispersed, as happened to the worldwide iridium-rich clay deposited by the KT impact we will encounter soon. Larger impacts create a complex crater, in which the cavity undergoes more extensive changes after the initial crater was established. This is best illustrated by Figure 27 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook. The central region rises up, while the rim partially collapses, because as the shock wave propagates through the ground, it interacts with the non-uniform rock to generate a new wave that propagates in the opposite direction of the shock wave and unloads the shock. This rarefaction wave pulls deep material to shallow depth, and leaves the crust thinned below large impact craters. The speed at which all this happens is remarkable. Depressions several kilometers deep can be created in seconds, and peaks can rise thousands of meters in minutes. Complex craters have an appearance different from the simple craters formed by smaller impacts. The precise crater shape depends on the size. When a crater is bigger than 2 kilometers across in layered sedimentary rock, or 4 kilometers across in stronger igneous or metamorphic crystalline rocks, it generally has a central uplifted region, a broad flat crater floor, and terraced walls. This is what is left after the initial compression, excavation, modification, and collapse. When the size is larger than 12 kilometers across, an entire plateau or ring might rise up in the center. All these clues are critical information when, metaphorically and sometimes literally, digging up the past. As we will see in Chapter 12, these distinctive features were helpful in the 1980s in identifying the crater in the Yucatan associated with the KT extinction. Craters on Earth. Many impact craters have been found in the last half century. By studying their chemical composition, as well as those of the scars known as astrobleems, the mostly destroyed craters that still leave identifiable impressions, we can begin to fill in our planet's visitor record. The guestbook is the Earth Impact Database. The Earth Impact Database certainly contains some of the more fascinating lists you can find on the internet. If you check it out, you will find catalogs of the many objects that have hit the Earth and left a scar big enough to be found and identified as an impact crater. This is not a complete list of impacts. Since a lot of the very old craters on Earth were wiped out by geological activity, most of the ones we observe here arose from more recent and less frequent impacts. Most strikes probably occurred more than 3.9 billion years ago in the early phase of the solar system, when material left over from the formation of the planets was swept up and moved around. But the Earth, Mars, Venus, and other more geologically active bodies have tended to lose evidence of the craters over time, which is why the geologically passive Moon shows them so much more prominently. Even evidence of more recent impacts is mostly now lost. Though they occur reasonably often, small hits don't leave a noticeable scar, at least for long. In fact, small craters are even less common than you might otherwise expect because of the Earth's dense atmosphere. Like on Venus and Titan, the atmosphere protects us from the many small impacts that occur much more often on Mercury and the Moon, where the atmosphere does not protect them. Larger impacts occur only rarely, pretty fortunate for the stability of life on the planet. An impact that is violent enough to produce a 20-kilometer-wide crater might occur and cause global damage once every few hundred thousand to a million years. Yet even this rate is not reflected in the Earth Impact Database. If you check it out, you will find evidence of only 43 such craters, and only 34 within the last 500 million years, 26 within the last 250 million years. A list appears in Figure 28 on the enhancement, and only about 200 structures in total. Crater List. Several factors account for the paucity of the crater record. The first relevant issue is that 70% of the Earth's surface is covered by oceans. Not only are underwater craters difficult to find, but water can interfere with the formation of a crater in the first place. Furthermore, geological activity in the ocean floor is likely to wipe out all but the more recent of any scars that did in fact form. Seafloor evidence is largely eliminated every 200 million years, since plate tectonics changes the ocean floor in a conveyor belt-like process of spreading and subduction that covers up any pre-existing evidence on this timescale. Even on the ground, geological activity such as erosion due to wind or water can destroy evidence. This is one reason most craters have been found in the more stable interior regions of continents and are more likely to be retained on planets with less geological activity, such as Venus. And of course, even if not as inaccessible as 4 kilometers underwater, meteoroids might land in less accessible regions on land, too. Finally, human processes can cover up evidence by changing the Earth's surface. So in some respects, it's remarkable that the list of craters is as big as it is. Several standouts are notable for being relatively recent events on geological timescales. Two 10-kilometer-wide craters were created within the last million years, one in Kazakhstan and one in Ghana. Two other notables are those in South Africa and in Canada, Fredefort and Sudbury. These are even bigger than the Chicxulub crater caused by the impact event that gave rise to the KT extinction, but were shaped in the far more distant past, a couple of billion years ago. The Sudbury mine in Canada was created to excavate the nickel and copper that became concentrated when the enormous object that created the crater struck and melted the crust. The impactor at Sudbury did not directly deliver most of the metals, but instead melted a huge sea-size volume of the Earth's crust that took a long time to crystallize. This left enough time for the small amounts of nickel and copper already present in the crust to settle to the bottom of the pool of impact melt. The metals were then further concentrated by hydrothermal activity generated by the hot impact melt sheet to produce economically recoverable ores. The Sudbury mine is famous among particle physicists because of an underground lab there. Though still an active mine, it is also an active physics experimental site. The Sudbury lab's deep underground location, 2 kilometers below the surface, shields detectors inside from cosmic rays, making the lab an ideal location to study neutrinos from the sun, as it did between 1999 and 2006. It is also an excellent place to search for dark matter, which is the goal of several experiments currently housed inside. But most impact stories are not quite so rosy. I'll soon describe the more recent Chicxulub impact event, which demonstrates the tremendous destructive capacity that large impacts can have. However, before presenting this incredible story of the meteoroid that triggered the KT extinction 66 million years ago, let's first reflect on the larger tale of the major extinctions of the past half a billion years and what they tell us about the fragility and stability of life on our planet. Chapter 11. Extinctions. Darwinian natural selection famously explains how life evolves. New species emerge, while species that can't successfully compete and adapt to changes in their environment, or access an alternative suitable habitat, die out. Yet despite its many successes, and they are indeed numerous, Darwinian evolution does not completely account for life as we know it. The most critical missing element is life's origin. Darwin helps us understand how some forms of life gave way to others once life had already emerged. But although evolutionary principles play a role, Darwin's ideas don't explain how life formed in the first place. Despite the many popular articles and books on the subject, origins are among the most difficult scientific questions to address, whether the issue is the start of life on Earth or the beginning of the universe that contains it. Ideas about later stages of development are amenable to the scientific method in that they can be tested, if not always by controlled experiments in a laboratory, then at least by examinations of the fossil record or the rich and ancient sky. The beginning, on the other hand, is almost always inaccessible. Theoretically inclined scientists who interpret or more likely speculate about what came before might attempt to tackle origin questions, and some experimentally oriented biologists might try to replicate processes essential to the formation of life in the early solar system. But despite this nascent process, the beginnings of life remain, at least for the time being, very challenging to ascertain. However, our focus in this chapter is on a different aspect of the story of life, one that, like life's origins, was not entirely encompassed by Darwin's initial theory of natural selection. This one, however, has the advantage that, like later stage evolution, it is amenable to observations. This important element of the story of life concerns how it responds to radical change, including mass extinctions, in which many species die out at about the same time, leaving no direct descendants in their wake. Central to the original Darwinian conception was the notion of gradualism, the idea that change occurs slowly over many generations. Darwin's theory wasn't about radical changes, and it certainly didn't envision changes induced by extraterrestrial incursions. Darwin's picture relied on slow evolution, whereas environmental catastrophes can be very sudden. The current theory of evolution does allow for much more rapid change than Darwin originally envisioned. The Princeton biologists Peter and Rosemary Grant, following in Darwin's footsteps, famously found that the beaks of finches in the Galapagos Islands adapted quite quickly to changing precipitation on a short enough timescale for the grants to see the changes in their successive visits. But catastrophes generally occur so rapidly and with such dramatic implications that they may make it impossible for species to survive. Dinosaurs had indeed adapted, and as a group, they survived for millions of years. Under other circumstances, they almost certainly would have survived many more, but they couldn't adapt to environmental conditions that they had never before experienced, which we will soon see originated in an object from outer space. Studies of evolution now recognize that adaptation is almost always too slow a process to cope with any but the most gradual environmental changes. Adaptations seem to yield species with truly distinct properties only in isolated environments. The favored response to changing conditions is most often migration to a new location with a more suitable environment. But of course, only if such an environment is accessible. When a species can't adapt or relocate to a suitable habitat, it doesn't stand a chance. In our rapidly changing environment, people would do well to take this into consideration. Technological advances notwithstanding, the lesson is probably relevant when evaluating the likely geopolitical implications of today's changing environment. Closer to our cosmic tale, the story of extinctions is of interest to us because of the connections between life on our planet and our celestial, solar, and possibly galactic environment. It is easy to forget how dependent our existence is on the many contingencies that allow life to form and to die out. This chapter discusses the notion of extinction, its causes, and the five largest mass extinction events in which a half to three-quarters of species died off. Paleontologists haven't converged on a single definition, within a several million year time frame, as well as a sixth mass extinction that might well be in the works. Extinctions connect our planet to meteorological events in both senses, weather and outer space. A better understanding of the connections is challenging, but could lie within our grasp. The science is important for us as a species, even if the stories unfold over longer time frames than most people tend to contemplate. Life and death. Simple life emerged relatively early in the Earth's history. The oldest rocks on the planet's surface contain evidence of life in fossils that date from about 3.5 billion years ago, about a billion years after the Earth's formation, and rather soon after it stopped being bombarded by asteroids and comets from space. Oxygenic photosynthesis emerged about a billion years later, and with it, an atmosphere that most likely triggered many extinctions, but which also precipitated the emergence of multicellular algae. About half a billion years later began the boring billion, in which no other radical development took place, at least that we know of. This long, tranquil interval suddenly ended at the beginning of the Cambrian period, about 540 million years ago, when complex life exploded. Our more detailed understanding of evolution applies from the Cambrian diversification to the present day, in the time frame known as the Phanerozoic Eon. The fossil record contains imprints right from its beginning, when many hard-shelled animals first appeared and generated a robust, lasting record, and most animal and plant life emerged. Fossils survive in regions as diverse as the Burgess Shale in the Canadian Rockies, the Yangtze Gorges of China, northeastern Siberia, and Namibia. All contain evidence for the widespread explosion of various types of life, as do the earlier Ediacara fossils in Australia, the Nama-type fossils in Namibia, the Avalon-type fossils in Newfoundland, and some fossils from the White Sea region of northwest Russia. These latter regions contain some of the earliest known complex life, from a time immediately preceding the Cambrian explosion. The fossil record, in addition to telling us about life's proliferation, provides insights into times when different forms of life disappeared without leaving any descendants. Although most of the fossils recording extinctions are very old, the notion of extinction is relatively new. Only in the early 1800s did the French naturalist and nobleman Georges Cuvier recognize the evidence that some species had entirely disappeared from the planet. Prior to Cuvier, when others had found older animal bones, they had invariably tried to relate them to existing species, which of course would have been a reasonable first guess. After all, mammoths and mastodons and elephants are different, but not so much that you might not initially confuse them, or at least try to relate their remains. Cuvier sorted it out when he demonstrated that mastodons and mammoths weren't ancestors of any currently living animals. He went on to identify many other now extinct species as well. But although the idea of extinctions is now firmly established, the idea that entire species could irreversibly disappear initially met with a lot of resistance. The concept of extinction must have been at least as difficult to reconcile with predominant beliefs back then as man-made climate change is for many today. The English geologist Charles Lyell, Charles Darwin, and Georges Cuvier all helped advance its acceptance, but not necessarily deliberately, and certainly from very different perspectives. Cuvier, unlike the others, took the point of view that radical transitions in the fossil record were the consequences of Earth-wide catastrophes. Strong support for his viewpoint was the observation that the rock at the point of rapid change in fossil types itself showed signs of cataclysmic events. Yet Cuvier didn't have the complete picture either. He overzealously believed in his idea that all extinct species were done in by catastrophic events, never acknowledging that gradual changes could also be contributing factors. Cuvier refused to accept either Darwin's evolutionary theory or the idea that species frequently went extinct through slow, persistent processes. In fairness, even now, people are confused when they see dramatic landscapes, not always appreciating the slow processes that helped shape them. A fellow speaker at an event in Colorado remarked during the drive to the venue upon the dramatic upheavals that he imagined had created the vertiginous sandstone cliffs on either side of the road. I reminded him that the relevant processes occurred over millions of years, albeit in fits and starts, not nearly so drastically as he had pronounced. At the time of Cuvier's proposal, most of the scientific establishment made the opposite mistake, opposing any role for catastrophic change. If the notion of extinction was a difficult pill to swallow a couple of centuries back, the idea of catastrophic change probably seemed more incredible still. Darwin was among those scientists who understood gradual change, but omitted the very ideas that to Cuvier were so essential. Darwin assumed that any evidence contradicting gradualism was simply a sign of the inadequacy of the geological or fossil record. Though he of course accepted evolution, he assumed it always happened far too slowly for anyone to actively observe. Darwin, in his thinking, followed the point of view of the influential Charles Lyell, who in the second half of the 19th century was still arguing that all changes were smooth and gradual, reasoning that any so-called evidence to the contrary was simply imperfect data caused either by gaps in the geological record or by erosion. Lyell, in turn, was inspired in part by the Scottish physician, chemical manufacturer, agriculturist, and geologist James Hutton, who thought the Earth changed only through tiny alterations that nevertheless yielded major effects over long periods of time. These scientists' ideas are indeed correct for many processes, both biological and geological. Rain and wind slowly erode mountains, which themselves can be the result of a gradual uplift over millions of years that is precipitated by sluggish plate movement. But we now know that both gradual and rapid changes shape the planet, though even the most radical changes would still rate as relatively slow from a human perspective. This is one of several reasons why these changes are so difficult to comprehend. Yet, with hindsight, we can look back and say the evidence for dramatic changes should have been obvious. Even as early as the 1840s, scientists had detected big gaps in the fossil record that were suggestive of catastrophic events. Paleontologists, studying the sedimentary record, identified such events when they noticed places where many fossil types suddenly ended at a boundary in the rock layer, above which evidence of a new species began. This is not to say the evidence was always immediately unambiguous, since many phenomena might cause sedimentation to cease and then resume. But with the identification of corresponding cataclysmic events and careful dating that could determine the relative timing of the deposition of earlier and later layers, paleontologists could resolve many confusions. Over time, the evidence for rapid changes became too strong to refute. Overcoming the hurdles. Scientists trying to reconstruct past events had to work extremely hard, however, to turn hypotheses into verifiable or falsifiable predictions. Even with an abundant fossil record, uncertainties in temporal or spatial resolution can point to very different hypotheses and conclusions. To understand the reasons for some of the continuing scientific debates, but also to appreciate just how clever and methodical the geologists and paleontologists who have surmounted these obstacles have been, let's briefly consider some of the challenges both in reliably ascertaining how quickly and extensively extinctions occurred and in determining the underlying cause. The first obstacle is simply the difficulty in evaluating the rate of extinctions. Counting the precise number of species that exist on the planet at any given time is difficult, since scientists would need to find, identify, and distinguish every type of mammal, reptile, fish, insect, and plant in existence. This applies even when counting existing species today, which should in principle be most accessible. The biologist E.O. Wilson, in The Future of Life, laments that there are too many discoveries of new species emerging every year for naturalists to write papers on all of them. Somewhere between 1 and 2 million existing species have been cataloged, with the best estimate lying between 8 and 10 million, though estimates up to 5 times higher can also be found. Not surprisingly, given the gap in time and the problems with identifying not only life from years past, but geological events and their influence, the extinction rate in the past is even more challenging to determine than the number of species existing today. After all, the number of past species and the rate at which they disappeared are then both harder to count. A confusing technicality when identifying mass extinctions in particular is that the associated number can vary according to the precise definition. I'll mostly refer to the number of species, though scientists frequently prefer to count genera, which they might find the more useful grouping. My facility with understanding the relevant biological categories, important to both evolution and extinction, is greatly assisted by my long-ago preparation for a high school examination when I memorized Kingdom, Phylum, Class, Order, Family, Genus, Species simply by saying it enough times. Try it. Despite my rarely calling on this knowledge, I have never forgotten these terms. These gradations, which might be unfamiliar to you, refer to how closely related are particular forms of life. The category makes a difference when evaluating whether a mass extinction occurred. For example, consider a circumstance in which more than half the species in each genus are wiped out. Only one species in a given genus needs to remain for that genus to survive. If indeed this is what came to pass, species counting would dictate that an extinction event had occurred since more than half of the species were eliminated, whereas genus counting would indicate otherwise since that number didn't change at all. This example, along with the arbitrary percentage that is used to precisely demarcate a mass extinction event, some say 50% and some say 75%, illuminates the somewhat fuzzy nature of the definition. This is not to say mass extinctions can be ignored, just that there is no ideal way to define them. The job of paleontologists is also burdened by more substantive factors than terminology. Clearly identifying and understanding disrupted fossil records is essential. If some species or genus leaves fossils in contiguous layers that are absent in the layers above, this would appear to signal an extinction event. But fossils are found only in sedimentary rock. The rare species that live in volcanic or other non-sedimentary environments generally won't leave any trace. An obstacle when studying older life forms from before the Cambrian period, about 540 million years ago, is the absence of hard body parts, which makes identifying fossil deposits from earlier times very challenging. But the more recent record is complicated too. Even if fossils do form, the interpretation can be confused by variations in the sedimentation and erosion rates that are essential to understanding fossils' implications. Terrestrial deposits occur episodically, while erosion on land acts steadily, whereas in a marine environment, sedimentary deposits are constant and erosion is episodic. This makes the marine record more comprehensive than the terrestrial one, which is generally far less complete. These factors mean that only parts of the fossil record survive, and that record, even when present, can be difficult to find and identify. Paleontologists succeed only because even though the probability of finding any individual is very low, given enough individuals from sufficiently many species over a long enough period of time, the sedimentary record will still be replete with fossils. Such fossils might be neatly preserved imprints of an entire individual, but more often they are only partial records, easily disguised evidence embedded in rock. Because generally only the hard parts of a species fossilize, the distinguishing body parts are frequently absent, causing different species to be conflated. Even if we were perfect at identifying fossils, erosion and other processes on Earth have readily hidden or destroyed many imprints well before they might have been found. On top of this, the Señor Lips effect can confuse the interpretation. This phenomenon, named after Phil Senior and Yere Lips, is tied to the rather intuitive idea that the last fossils of a species will be located at different geological times in different places, making the extinction tend to appear less abrupt and more gradual than it actually was. According to Senior and Lips, the variation in depth of the last remnant fossils over a spatially extended region doesn't decisively establish whether an extinction occurred gradually or suddenly. This ambiguity can make the precipitating cause of a given extinction difficult to ascertain. Researchers often prefer marine fossils because they are generally better preserved. In the 19th century, clams, ammonites, corals, and other fairly large species were most accessible, while in the 20th century, geologists with more advanced tools started using microfossils, like the one-celled foraminifera, which are abundant and widespread and preserved both underwater and in uplifted limestone, to get more detailed information. A further consideration when establishing extinctions is that both the fossil records and the absolute ages are important. The fossil record, in conjunction with the geological formations in which they are found, can help establish relative ages. Since different time periods hosted different species, the types of fossils present help determine the relative times in which they were formed. But finding the absolute and not just relative ages of a boundary rock layer is often difficult and requires methods to date formations that are independent of the fossil record. One method that geologists often use for this purpose is isotopic analysis. With isotopic analysis, scientists determine the ratio of different isotopes of an atom, in which the number of protons is the same, but the number of neutrons is different, reasoning that if you know how long it takes for one isotope to decay into another, and you also know what you started with, you can then determine how old something is by how much of an atom type remains. Carbon dating is perhaps the best known example of this method. It is used to determine the age of older organic materials and is indeed very precise. However, given the half-life of carbon isotopes, it is effective only for stuff less than 50,000 years old, making it inadequate for dating the older rocks and most of the Phanerozoic. Longer-lived isotopes are used instead. But isotopic analysis is more difficult when applied to older rocks. Generally, only trace amounts of the relevant isotopes are present, and the age determination is not always sufficiently precise. For example, potassium decaying to argon is an important process for dating. But argon gas in rocks can escape into the atmosphere, making rocks appear younger than they actually are. Or it can be trapped in the rock when first formed, leading to more argon and the appearance of an older formation. Methods have significantly improved in the last few decades, as cross-correlations of various elements have made studies even better, and detailed probes of even minute elements becomes more accessible. The recent dating of the meteoroid and the KT extinction event, using lasers to remove gas from argon crystals, which I'll mention in the following chapter, provides a spectacularly accurate example. Magnetic information has also been used to help establish absolute ages. This method, which was initially employed for rocks relative to the dinosaur extinction, relies on geomagnetic reversals. But because the Earth's crust is made of moving tectonic plates, the magnetic field's orientation changes over time so that the initial orientation can be hard to reconstruct, compromising the reliability of the results. Perhaps that was a good thing in that its inadequacy precipitated the search for another method by the geologist Walter Alvarez and his father, the physicist Luis Alvarez, which led to the meteoroid hypothesis that I will soon explain. Proposed explanations for extinctions. The hard work of geologists and paleontologists has unquestionably demonstrated that spectacular changes occurred in the past that wiped out most life on the planet. Once this had been established, the questions turned to how and why they occurred. We've experienced a number of devastating storms and disasters in recent years, but none individually has been nearly powerful enough to eliminate half the species on the planet. Of course, the final verdict on the cumulative effect of human influence is yet to be determined. But what precipitated the world-changing disasters that have occurred in the past? Before getting to a list of cataclysmic events that can trigger extinctions, Let's first consider the rather short list of environmental factors that might come into play. Temperature or precipitation changes, in either direction, have been two important contributors. Broadly speaking, species that have adapted to their local environment are not necessarily able to adapt when weather patterns change. As with the melting of the Arctic ice, the environment for particular species can change so dramatically in response to the changing temperature that existing species, which can't adapt sufficiently quickly, have to move to a suitable habitat or perish. Climate change has less direct effects too, of course, one of the most significant being the change in sea levels, which can destroy stable marine environments and flood previously habitable land masses, turning terrestrial environments into oceanic ones and thereby eliminate some land-dwelling species. Warming oceans can affect precipitation patterns too, again influencing species' chances of survival. On shorter timescales, parasites or diseases, the dangers of which can be exacerbated by climate change, can also contribute to extinctions, and the food on which a species depends might die off, triggering a domino effect in the food chain. In the oceans, change in acidity is a further potential kill mechanism, as is oxygen depletion. Finally, the formation of barriers that can lead to isolated, vulnerable populations, or the removal of barriers that can permit invasive species or over-homogenizing of populations, are two other factors that can doom a species. Any extinction trigger causes at least one of the disasters I've just described, and most of them cause several in combination. But why do these changes occur? What environmental change triggered them? Two competing viewpoints dominate the thinking on the subject. One is that they occurred gradually, a point of view often connected to earthbound phenomena such as volcanoes or plate tectonics. The dust and soot that a volcano emits can block sunlight and produce significant enough changes in the atmosphere to affect the temperature. But it can take a while for life forms to die out as a consequence. Plate tectonics, which can influence habitats and environments, is another suggested cause of the gradual eradication of species. Along with changes in oceans, plate tectonics can affect climate and land coverage, and both of these lead to dramatic modifications to life on the planet. Of course, if either volcanism or plate tectonics is relevant to extinctions, most likely both are, since they tend to happen concurrently. Then there are the big events. This opposing viewpoint encompasses externally imposed extraterrestrial catastrophes, such as large meteoroid impacts. But it can include destructive terrestrial events too, if they happen sufficiently suddenly. Proposals for terrestrially induced catastrophes rely on well-known phenomena that might suddenly transpire at an accelerated pace. For example, we know volcanoes erupt at various intervals, but in Siberia and on the Deccan Plateau of southern India, basaltic lava layers extend over an enormous region called a trap. A trap contains lava layers that extend into a large plateau which arose from extremely high volcano eruption rates that emitted enormous amounts of lava that spread over a large region. The Deccan and Siberian traps are signs of much more violent volcanic activity and eruption rates than usual. Even today, despite erosion, the lava from the Siberian traps occupies 1 million square kilometers at least, and a few 100,000 cubic kilometers volume. Ash from the kind of extensive volcanic activity that formed the traps would have caused serious damage. You might recall from news reports how ash can spread densely enough to interfere with aircraft, as happened in April 2010 when the Icelandic volcano Eyjafjallajökull erupted. More vigorous volcanic activity can give rise to more substantial global effects, such as significant changes in the planet's weather. Eruptions emit large amounts of sulfur dioxide. This might increase the amount of water vapor in the upper atmosphere and contribute to a greenhouse effect and hence global warming on short timescales. On longer timescales, these same volcanoes might cause global cooling. That's because the sulfur dioxide that is emitted rapidly combines with water to create sulfuric acid. This condenses to form fine sulfate aerosols that radiate sunlight back into space, thereby cooling the lower atmosphere. It works so well that deliberately injecting sulfur into the atmosphere is one strategy that scientists are investigating as a precarious climate engineering response to climate change. Sulfate aerosols can also destroy the ozone in the atmosphere and lead to acid rain. Feedback effects, both known and unknown, might also create even more long-lasting weather phenomena. However, volcanic activity alone won't explain all extinctions. Activity extensive enough to destroy the majority of life on Earth is rare. More exotic suggestions for triggers of rapid and catastrophic mass extinctions center on cosmic events. Changes in the Earth's axis and orbit occur too, and are responsible for some of the climate changes, such as ice ages, that occur on timescales of tens or hundreds of thousands of years. But these Earth motions are unlikely to explain the massively destructive events that occur so much less frequently. Cosmic rays and supernovae, as well as cosmic impacts, have been suggested as potential culprits, with the potential to be relevant on longer timescales. Cosmic rays can affect cloud cover in several ways. One is by ionizing atoms in the troposphere so that water droplets can nucleate nearby. This influence could enhance cloud formations, which would in turn affect the Earth's weather. However, this theory doesn't necessarily hold water, so to speak. First of all, we don't know how important cosmic rays are relative to other potential ionizing sources. Second, the nuclei, even when formed, have to grow enormously by condensation before they are truly forming clouds. Third, the effect of clouds isn't clear. They could cool the Earth by reflecting sunlight, or alternatively, they could heat it further by re-radiating some of the energy. In any case, correlations that have been measured between cosmic rays and climate don't suffice to explain the enormous changes over a short time period required to precipitate extinctions. Supernovae have also been suggested as possible extraterrestrial extinction triggers. The proposed mechanism concerns the energetic X-rays and cosmic rays that supernovae release. This radiation could, in principle, kill life directly by destroying cellular or genetic material. The radiation could also deplete the ozone layer or lead to nitrogen dioxide formation, which would in turn lead to global cooling by absorbing sunlight. However, despite these potential dangers, supernovae are unlikely to explain extinctions for exactly the reason you might suspect. Supernovae that are close enough to cause major problems don't occur sufficiently enough. Although the supernova rate increases when the Earth passes through the spiral arms of the galaxy where the density of supernovae is greater, the likelihood of the Earth passing close enough to them is still too low to account for extinction events. Similarly, gamma ray bursts don't occur frequently enough to explain most extinctions. According to some estimates, they occur only every billion years or so in the Milky Way. A far more compelling candidate for a cosmic extinction trigger is a comet or an asteroid that makes impact on Earth. An enormous object hitting the planet can precipitate dramatic changes on the ground, in the air, and in the oceans. If something sufficiently big hits, major and for some species fatal changes in the Earth's surface and climate would follow immediately. In fact, essentially most of the great movie disaster scenarios, with the exception of a zombie apocalypse, follow in the wake of a sufficiently big impact. The impact itself creates shock blasts, fires, earthquakes, and tsunamis. Dust can block out the atmosphere, temporarily ending photosynthesis and eliminating most of the food sources for most animals. Climate changes induced by the strike wreak havoc as well, both initial heating and later cooling, and possible further heating after that. Cooling comes from sulfates and dust that remain in the atmosphere, while the later heating is a possible result of toxic and heat-trapping gases that could set off global warming. A meteoroid did indeed cause at least one mass extinction event that the next chapter will explain in detail. This calamity was one of the five big extinction events that took place during the Phanerozoic Eon. The Big Five. In 1982, the University of Chicago paleontologists Jack Sepkoski and David M. Raup revolutionized the field of paleobiology with their pioneering quantitative analysis of all the field's existing data. The many imperfections in the observations and the many decisions that are needed to decide what to include and how made their numerical data-driven study tricky. Yet they realized that statistics can be useful even when applied to imperfect or incomplete data if enough of it is available, and that was indeed the case. Although the 1982 Raup and Sepkoski paper was not the first quantitative study of the fossil record, it reoriented the study of extinctions, which had formerly relied far more on narrative and small-scale investigations. In their research, the Chicago paleontologists identified five major mass extinctions and about 20 lesser ones in which approximately 20% of life forms died out. Take a look at the chart in Figure 29 on the enhancement. Because of the very strong differences in evolutionary dynamics and the less available and reliable evidence from earlier on, Raup and Sepkoski focused on life and its destruction in the past 540 million years. The emergence and disappearance